Episode 4 of the Sales Change Podcast. This episode, we're talking to James Hampton from The Colourworks. So The Colourworks' mission is to create vibrant workplaces in which people feel valued and get heard. They work with businesses in order to improve corporate culture. So it's a really interesting podcast. We have a chat about what factors affect the psychometric profile, which is something that The Colourworks do. Is it environment or is it fundamentally the same, but with the environment being a contributory factor to performance? We discuss self-worth and how this affects performance. One interesting part of the podcast is we talk about the three actions that a new leader could do to change a company's culture right now. Are all psychometric profiles wishy-washy nonsense, or are they accurate as The Colourworks would want you to believe? How do The Colourworks recruit? And do they have candidates who try and manipulate the process? James also goes into the Sales Change 5 questions. This is a really interesting podcast. There's lots of additional material on the website. Remember, visit www.saleschange.co.uk. Rate us 5 stars, leave us a review. Enjoy the episode. James Hampton, welcome to the Sales Change Podcast. Tell me about The Colourworks.
So The Colourworks is an internationally renowned learning and development organisation, and we deliver solutions across the private, public and not-for-profit sectors. We specialise in human behaviour, believing that performance in individuals, teams and leaders is rooted in how we behave. So if we can understand a little bit more about how we come across to other people, what holds us back, our strengths, our weaknesses, then we can improve performance in those mentioned arenas.
So are The Colourworks unique? Are they the only company that does it, or are there other companies that do exactly the same as yours? Because this is, for me, what you do is unique. I don't know anybody else who does it.
Yeah, there's not many people out there. I mean, there are a lot of companies out there who use psychometrics or personality profiles to improve performance. We're unique in the sense that we are purists in the insights discovery model itself, which is a world-renowned diagnostic and validated by the British Psychological Society. So it's well known, it's got a lot of credibility, and we use that at the core of everything we do. It kind of is a springboard to the future development that we work with clients for.
So when you work with clients, do you go into a company, psychometric test everybody, and then see how that team would fit together? Because obviously I know how psychometrics work, and we'll get onto that later in the podcast. But do you go in and say, right, this leader is more red, this leader is more yellow, and then try and shift the team so that it works cohesively?
Yeah, the opposite way around, actually. We go in and work with intact teams, or when teams are being built, let's say, on the belief that it's not about what colour energy you have, what behavioural type you are. We're not measuring skill or competency here. We're looking at behaviour. And all we're doing is we're exploring how people might execute a task or approach a job or behave in that particular way. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that I am one type of behaviour. I can't do something else. So it's about raising self-awareness and helping people be the best they can be so the team can play to the collective strengths.
So within a team then, would you say that the direction and the pace of the company is set by the leader, and that psychometric or personality from the top is intrinsically linked to how the company operates?
Yeah, it'd be very true to say that the leadership or the leadership team mm-hmm. and the behaviours of the leadership team will set the culture, because people in organisations are pretty simple. They do as they see, and that's how culture is formulated. So by having the leadership team or the leader understand more about how their behavior is driving the results or the direction of that particular team, it can help kind of cover the gaps and understand where there might be some strengths that need to be elicited a little bit more that yep. are being ignored.
And on the flip side, weaknesses that you can probably try and mitigate to try and remove or work on in order to improve the overall culture of the company.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And helping people become aware of those weaknesses and those things that might hold them back. And there may be some elements of an individual's job that they find incredibly challenging because they're not innately comfortable to do that. But when looking at a team and building a team, it's about, you know, surrounding yourself with those people that are not like you and building those trusting relationships.
Yeah, I find it very difficult in teams where I don't like somebody because I like a team that works like a functioning unit. I do recognize that sometimes I have weaknesses, and within my psychometric profile, which is available on the Sales Change website and on the episode page, in my psychometric profile, it gives out clear indications about people that are my opposite type. And those generally in life for me are people that I don't get on with.
Mm-hmm.
They're, and it's as plain as that. They're it's a very strong word, but weak-minded and people who can't make decisions and sort of the wishy-washy nature of some people, that doesn't sit right with me, and it makes me feel physically uncomfortable.
Yeah.
If I had people like that in my team, I'd find it very difficult to manage them. And that's probably where your company would help me in delivering a strategy or a business plan so that I could include those people in that plan.
That's right. That's right. So you're very extroverted, forthright, get the job done, make it happen. I'm not going to take any prisoners here. I'm going to say a spade and just get on and do it.
Correct.
Can sometimes come across a little bit aggressive, overbearing, a little bit too much for other people. And in that approach, although you'll achieve a lot in a very short space of time, you forget about the people aspect. You know, there's the relationships and the emotions that people might feel actually quite disengaged by your directness. And although you're achieving those goals and those milestones, there's people just left in your bow wake. So
I also think I'm very, when I assess a leader, I what I would call a leader is three main traits. And I say transparency, empathy, and honesty. So when I lead and I talk to my team, I'm completely transparent. I see it from their position so that I can elicit a response which is beneficial to both me and the company, and it's completely transparent and honest. I'm not. Mm-hmm. There's no ulterior motive. If I say we can't do something, mm-hmm. then we can't do it, and I'll explain why we can't do it, whether it's to balance the books or whether it's because that's not the direction that the company is moving. So I am very direct, but I think I'm also very empathetic, which helps build a team. On one of your podcasts, you interviewed Giles, and he talks about the trust equation,
yeah.
which is kind of similar because you've got trust equals credibility plus reliability plus intimacy, and all of that is above self-interest.
Yeah.
If you're in there to make money and make a quick buck and then get out, people won't. You're not credible, you're not reliable, and you won't have the intimacy. You can't build that bridge.
That's right.
So that's where I think the transparency and the honesty works for me, because mm-hmm. I'm completely transparent and honest, which means that my team buy into me. So yes, I am very direct, but I think you've got to build that bridge between people, and it's people skills.
It is people skills, but there's also treating people in the way that they like to be treated, not necessarily the way that you like to be treated. And this is what we talk about, adapting and connecting. So although you have people in your team who are not like you, and you might find them very frustrating, they bring an amazing amount of gifts to the table. You know, they bring all of the compassion, the people, or the glue that holds it all together. They never forget anybody's birthday. You know,
yeah, I'm terrible with that.
You know, they do, because everything that you do not have, they have. And although we find them incredibly frustrating and sometimes really weird, those who are not like me, they hold all the gifts. So as a leader, surrounding yourself by those people, actually they compliment you.
Yeah, it's something that I've definitely learned over the last couple of years, is to let go of some of the stuff, because I'm also somebody who likes to do everything. And for example, this week we've created some exhibition banners, and I'm very into the marketing side. I like to post on social media, all about the company, but I have to let it go because I haven't got the time.
Yeah.
So I have to trust the people to do that. And that's something that's really big for me. And it's really important for me. At the Colourworks, do you use the same tools that you do in other companies on the Colourworks themselves?
Yeah, we do. We, as much as we can, we try and practice what we preach.
Yeah.
I run all the internal team development. So every month we have an hour and a half masterclass, and each of those masterclasses are in one of the solutions that we offer our clients. So we sit and we share our profiles, we talk about strengths and weaknesses, we talk about levels of trust. We've got a couple of extra diagnostics as well, called a team performance indicator, which is a 48 question survey that looks at the team in its entirety and where the strengths and weaknesses. Everyone answers it anonymously, so you get a real true sense of what people are thinking. So we run that on ourselves every 6 months as well, just to temperature check where we are and to see whether the team direction is working. We also have a leadership 360 tool, and I do that on myself every 12 months, just so I can keep an eye on how I'm perceived, how my people perceive me, what they see in me.
What's the leadership 360? Is that your people answering questions about you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I take a group of people, I ask clients, a wider team, our internal team, and give them a link to a survey. It's a 24-question survey that then takes that information and puts it into a couple of measurements of how I see myself, how they see me, mm-hmm. how different groups see me, which is a real insightful moment. It can be a bit sensitive on occasions because people are commenting upon your behavior, and that's quite a hard thing to swallow occasionally.
Yeah, yeah.
But when we're out there in organizations and we're talking to leaders about expanding self-awareness, you know, and getting feedback, I believe we have to have that real life experience before we can go out and say, yeah, you need to do this to increase your own performance. And if I can come to the table with some real life stories of how I've found situations challenging, gathered feedback and processed it myself and done something about it, then I think that's leading from the front.
You say you do this every 12 months. Have you seen a growth in yourself where you've changed, say, let's say negative behaviors or something that's a weakness that you've perceived or somebody else has perceived? Do you then see that reflected back in 12 months later where you've completely changed that?
Yeah, and it's an interesting point to make because these diagnostics aren't necessarily about tracking development. Mm-hmm. We're not assessing it because you change on a physical level, on an emotional level.
Yeah.
Your environment changes, your values change and they evolve. So different things become important at different times. A business grows. So moving from a small business into a larger business and managing people, you have to adapt to that. So kind of your behavior ebbs and flows. But the really important thing about any of those diagnostics are the conversation that follows. So although people have scored you and given you this measurement, it's sitting down with those individuals and saying, look, okay, so you see this particular side of me. Mm-hmm. Can we explore this so I get the evidence to underpin it so that next time I'm faced with it, I can consciously be aware of what I might need to do to adapt my style? I'm not saying that I've done it 100% by any means.
But that would lead generally to better relationships, I'm sure.
Hugely, yeah. I mean, it really does expand your key stakeholder group, you know, those people who aren't on the survey, when you can step out of maybe your team and go and talk to a client, for instance, and say, look, am I managing you appropriately? You know, I give all the inspiration and I give all the recommendations, but, you know, do you need more follow through from me? Do you need me to be more critical towards you? It's a really valuable conversation to have that deepens a relationship.
So you've got that Leadership 360 and that's the feedback for you. My psychometric or discovery profile was done in 2015. Would that have an impact on the discovery profile? Would that change my core being over a period of time? So would the discovery profile in 2015 be as accurate as it is today? Would that be the same?
In the sense, have you changed?
Yes. The behaviours and the type of person I am within my discovery profile, I feel are still accurate today.
Yeah.
But would, let's say, if I had a poor boss or a really good boss or the work environment was different, would that change the core of the discovery profile or is it just standard throughout? So once I've had one, I don't need another one for the rest of my life.
Well, the lifespan of a discovery profile, they recommend, is up a couple of years, subject to any major life change, any major work change, because those things influence our behaviours. I've been completing profiles now for 12 years, yearly. Yeah. So I've done a few of these. But every time I complete a profile, I track what's going on in my life and how that's actually influencing not just the narrative in the profile, but the charts and graphs where the profile actually takes a measurement of where I'm expressing my energy in the different types of behaviour. So we see a lot of change that takes place in those measurements, in the data. And yes, you can move around in your type mobility where you pull on different types of behavior. But the likelihood of you know, up in sticks and setting up camp on the opposite side is pretty low. If you do, and occasionally we see that, it can be a transitional period in an individual's life, whether there's something going on like a marriage, a divorce, a death, something quite impactful, but typically it's temporary. It's a transitional process.
So would having a bad boss impact your discovery process?
Yeah. Yeah, it will impact how you see yourself and how you score those words.
Oh, yeah, because it's an introspective process. You're looking at yourself rather than other people judging you. There's obviously going to be an outward personality change because you're going to feel down, you're going to feel sort of neglected or any of those like bad personality traits. But inside, the introspective view is going to be the same, kind of.
Yeah, kind of. What I see, and I've delivered a lot of this workshop and met a lot of people and introduced them to the discovery profile. And I think one of the most profound moments of the whole session is when people say, my God, now I get it. Now I get it. And they read their profiles and they say, have you been following me? And it's just exceptional. And typically, by allowing people to actually read through some black and white narrative of their behavior, it really helps them grasp their strengths and weaknesses rather than just it be played around in the internal dialogue.
Yeah. Are discovery insights real? Or are they, because we were talking just before the podcast about the Derren Baron
experiment where he had 10 people in a room and he gave them a sheet of paper with a breakout of exactly what who that type of person was. But then at the end of the episode, the kicker was that he'd given the same piece of paper to everybody.
Yeah.
So is it a, you're writing a profile which would fit 10 people, or is it actually unique to that person?
Yeah, it's, it, and star signs and all of the other things are following now. It's a good comparison to make, simply because Derren Brown and the stuff that he does is manipulation and suggestion. What we don't see in those controlled experiments is the things that the individuals in those rooms have been exposed to prior to that. So those individuals are primed and nudged. So they're given particular pictures of countries or symbolism or along those lines, which goes into their mind. So when they actually read those documents and those reports, they're almost primed and set up to see those things in front of them. It's very different to the discovery profile, because the discovery profile is based on the work of a chap called Carl Jung, who was a Swiss psychologist who formulated this theory of personality. And he is how we understand personality today. Within the discovery model itself, there are up to 72 types that you can fall into. And if I were to give you my profile based on how I answer the questions, it would read very, very differently to yours.
Yeah.
Because we have different first, second, third, and fourth color energies. The beauty of the discovery model itself is the narrative is so vast. So although someone might fall into a similar position of those 72, they could sit next to each other in a workshop, and although their color energy order be relatively similar,
yep,
the narrative will read really differently. It's really unique to that individual.
So would social, so the upbringing or social circles, that would have an impact on, because obviously it's an introspective look. So somebody who, let's say a set of twins, one grew up in an affluent area, one grew up in a really poor neighborhood, and they had very similar discovery wheels because they're twins and their personalities are the same. They would obviously act differently, but introspectively, they would probably be the same. Because if we went through my discovery wheel is very similar to another chap that I know who I used to manage. And we have very similar sort of ways of managing. We're very direct. We're very forthright. We're very outspoken. We know exactly what we want and how to get it. However, his role was completely different to mine, mm-hmm, and he succeeded just as well.
Yeah.
But we were exactly the same people. He could have, I think my question is, could he have stepped into my role and done my role? And could I have stepped into his and done his in exactly the same way?
No, not exactly the same way, but you'd have achieved it in a different manner.
Yeah.
And what you're talking about here is behavior is what you see. It's what you observe. You know, you're not the same people, because what lies beneath is everything that fuels our behavior. So we have our conscious and less conscious thoughts. We've got our physiology, our biochemistry. Everything else that happens underneath is fueled by our values and our experiences. That's all completely unique to us. And what we're not aiming to do within the discovery model here is just to type people or position people or say, because you're in the same place, you're exactly the same. The likelihood is you're going to get on really well,
yeah,
because you see the world from a very similar perspective. But underneath, there's all this other stuff that fuels that behavior.
Can you teach someone to be a leader, or is it a natural skill?
So, research tells us that although some people are more naturally capable at becoming a leader, it's a completely learnable skill. What it requires is the motivation and attitude to do so. And then once that individual engages in theories like emotional intelligence,
yep,
self-reflection, self-management, becomes socially aware of how their behaviors are seen, they can very successfully move into a leadership role. In fact, I've had quite a few coaching clients who have stepped up from being in a team into a leadership role, and some edges just needed to be shaped a little bit, and they've become aware of it and done something about it through the tools that we've already discussed in the podcast.
Does that also include self-confidence? Because self-confidence is a key attribute to becoming an entrepreneur or a business leader. You have to have the confidence in the direction that you're set in or the narrative that you're transmitting. Do you think self-confidence is important when you're a leader?
I absolutely think it's important. Yeah, self-confidence. Yeah. It's a very difficult thing sometimes to build self-confidence, self-belief, or even self-trust. And that comes from continuously practicing it and realizing that you are capable and able to do that.
Sometimes I have the imposter syndrome, and I don't understand how or why I'm in the position I'm in.
I get that. Me too.
Yeah, and it's so strange, because I sit there one day in my office and I'm thinking, these people actually listen to me, and I'm crazy, and I don't know what I'm doing. But That's a lie. I do know what I'm doing, but it's just that it's. I think it's that introspective look of at yourself and wondering, am I doing everything all right?
Yeah.
Am I doing okay? But my boss has a confidence in me because he put me in the position to run the UK and the US arm. So I must be doing something right. So it's just that self-doubt sometimes.
Yeah, I think that's twofold for me and that imposter syndrome. I think it's a challenging thing to have because it causes self-doubt, but it also creates a hunger to be better at what you do. So it's twofold for me, and I completely agree with you. I get it on a regular basis, and I stand in front of people who are very intelligent senior leaders of organizations and think, what gives me the right to stand in front of them and talk about this area of psychology or team building or authenticity or trust or honesty? And actually, you know, 20 minutes in, it works because you bring these people together and they don't share the things that you bring to the table.
Yeah.
So that self-doubt kind of goes very rapidly once you're in the mood.
I think my key skill is getting people to do what I want them to do and making them think that it's their idea, because it's a very strange skill, because I know that I want them to do that thing and then they do that thing because I've asked them to do it, but not in a boss sense, but in a leader sense. Come along with me and we'll solve this together.
Yeah.
That type of scenario.
Because intent is more powerful than knowledge.
yes. So given that I get people to do the stuff that I want them to do, what's your ideal definition of a leader or a boss or a company head? My view is that they need to be empathetic, the honest, and all the other stuff that I said. What would you say it is?
I think it's to a degree subjective to the eyes of the beholder. My personal idea about the ideal manager, boss, the sort of person that I would like to believe that I'm seen as, is empathetic, the coach. So they empower people to do what they can do by giving them the tools to actually deal with it themselves. And rigor. I think rigor is really important. You know, the thoroughness that a leader must bring to investigate every angle. Combining those behaviours, I think, is quite a challenge because they can be opposing. But I think it's really important for a leader to bring that rigor to a team environment.
I mean, I suppose I do that in a sense. And my passion has been over the last couple of years to go into a company, shake up the processes, shake up the sales team, and generate some success. If you had to go into a company and say, right, we're going to change three things here, you're only allowed to change three things. And I'm talking that this company is probably sort of meandering through using practices that were in the 1980s, still using fax machines or that like proper aged, old manufacturing type companies, or in an old car garage scenario type. You can imagine the company I'm talking about. What three things would you do in order to change the culture of the company? What would you do to change the sales team's belief in themselves? It's a very good question.
It is. That's a big question. A big question. I think the first thing that I would approach is the levels of self-awareness. I think, you know, what we do when we work with organizations is we go in at what I believe is the root cause of any issue in an organization, and that's the people that are in it. And if we can raise their levels of self-awareness, we can raise their levels of self-confidence. And if we can raise their levels of self-confidence, we can get them to engage in what could be quite difficult conversations that haven't been addressed before, which will increase the levels of trust in that particular organization and get people on the same page and all rowing in the same direction.
Yeah. So just openness with everybody. So not just from the top, but from the bottom, the people that work in the garage itself, let's say, if we're using that scenario, but everybody has a voice and everybody needs to feed into the common narrative of the company.
That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think if we're able to create an environment where people have that sense of openness and they trust their colleagues and they have that sense of belonging, I think we might start to go some way to addressing some of the mental health issues that we're seeing in organizations and out there at the moment. Because if I can share my troubles and woes with my colleagues, that's going to go a very long way to me battling some of the demons that I'm playing with in my own mind.
Yeah. Do you support your employees' well-being at The Colourworks?
Yeah, so we have, we've all been off and done the mindfulness-based stress reduction course with Dorset Mindfulness Centre, Robert Gebke, which was absolutely brilliant, and I'd highly recommend going on it, whether you feel stressed out or whether you don't. It really brings some clarity around how our thoughts interact with our physiology and how just taking some time out to be in the moment, focus on our breathing, can rebalance us and assist us in managing some of those typically destructive thoughts that can take place, and allow us to be in a much better physical position to have some difficult conversations, engage with our family, talk to our partners and loved ones, manage our children.
Yeah.
You know, all these things that might actually really frustrate us.
Yeah.
Not that my family or wife frustrates us.
Just in case she's listening.
typically they see the best side of us, right?
Yeah. Always. So that was a slight tangent from my original question, which was the three things that we would change. So the first thing was openness and transparency, like get everybody to get a voice. So what would the other two things be?
So a direction.
Yep.
Direction, so clarity around vision. Where's a company going and how does that translate into individual tasks and roles and responsibilities?
Yep. And the last one?
The last one will be, well, this is teased by my own personal preferences, but compassion that might flow throughout team members and colleagues. So everyone actively taking responsibility over one another's care.
That's really interesting, actually, because in my last company, they called it a day in the life. And the managing director would spend a day in the life with the engineers.
That's great.
The sales, I sat with the sales inside sales team so that I get to understand how they process all the documents. But it also gives you a sense of empathy because you're understanding where they are in that position. And we're just about to launch exactly the same thing at my current company so that everybody understands what stresses and strains. Because at my company, production don't understand when sales teams are busy and the sales team don't understand when the production team is busy. And it's just a minefield because they sit in their own small bubble.
And this is, by doing such things, you're really addressing things like innovation and creativity. You're not just managing the interdepartmental relationships where people are pulling together and understanding, but actually me coming into your department and talking about what you do can really bring a different idea to the forefront. It can really stimulate new thoughts about what might be going on and better the process.
Yes. So in my last company, when we carried out this role, this job switch and the day in the life, we found that when somebody sat in another person's role, we could see and understand the process, but also find little things that could be improved upon, little like where to save documents or how many documents to save, and all this things that, because you're in that bubble, you don't see on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely, your vision becomes narrow.
Yeah, so we've got transparency throughout the company, we've got direction, and we've got...
Compassion.
So at the Colourworks, Giles started, then you've joined and you've gone through that process. I heard that on the last podcast that you did. How have you managed that growing process? Because obviously you've had to add people into your team. Do you use psychometrics when you recruit, or is there a particular recruitment sort of model that you use in order to bring people into the team?
Yeah, sure. So we have quite a robust onboarding process when we go out looking for new team members, whether they be facilitators or the internal team. When we opened in 2003, we were solely using the discovery profiles and we were delivering maybe 1 or 2 days, and we gathered quite a strong reputation for being an impactful company who can make an immediate difference. But as we've grown, we knew that we needed to change the business model slightly and cater for an organization's wider needs. So in about 2014, we went out and we surveyed a couple of hundred clients, and we went out and just said, right, give us your top five people-focused pain points. You know, what's causing your headache? And we took all that data and information in, and we created what's now known as 18 solutions that will solve or resolve any of these particular issues. So our business growth has gone from being just kind of a very transactional one-day organization into managing an organization's needs right the way through. So that was the massive jump in our business growth when we changed that model.
Yeah.
Because we were working with clients in a lot more greater depth, a lot greater length. So when we needed to acquire new team members, for us it's about attitude rather than skill. If it's the right fit for the team with the right ethos and values, then the skill can be developed and built over time.
That's exactly what I do when we recruit at Safi. Our recruitment process is two-stage. The first stage is the team that person is going to work in. We'll do the interview, and that could be the production manager, it could be just somebody who works in the warehouse.
Yeah.
They do that interview process because invariably they've got to spend their working day with that person. Then what we do is we have a pool of candidates and we'll select two or three that fit sort of our model and our culture. And then I will then interview to make sure that A, they're not an idiot. And then secondly, that the team have picked the right person.
Yeah.
Because I think the direction and the culture should flow from the top. And if I set the culture, but we poorly recruit and we put people into positions which they're not suited for,
yeah,
then it's it'll just disrupt what I'm trying to implement.
That's absolutely right. Absolutely right. So, you know, when we meet a new candidate, they go through the formal interview process and then they go through another two stages of meetings, which is involved in the actual job, seeing what's happening with the people they're working with. And then I'll also spend some time with them talking about what we do as a company in the sense of the profiles and what they really need and their appetite for developing, because that's ingrained in us as a company. And there are some people who are not yet ready to do that. And we don't want to force this upon people, but we do want to surround ourselves with people who are willing to put themselves out there to actually develop, you know, and grow as a human being and as a professional.
I wonder, because obviously you guys are big into people development and you understand behaviours, do you think there are people that come to your company and try to trick you, use reverse psychology and try and get the role that they want, but they're not actually the type of person, because just to see if the process works? Is
Yeah, they do, absolutely. And you know, I've mentioned the data that comes from the profiles as well. We can very easily catch them out.
Right.
Because within that online evaluator, you only need to answer a very much smaller amount of questions than the 25 that are there. Yeah. The other remaining questions are just ensuring there's congruency within your answers. And what that then does, if people are answering it in a false manner, it gives a false reading on the data.
Right, okay. Because I wonder if your team do that as well. Whether your team know how... Like, if I had an insight in how discovery models worked,
yeah,
I would try and manipulate them in order to create this persona of myself, which I wanted to be,
yeah,
rather than who I actually truly am.
Yeah, and that's right. I mean, what we're looking at is a diagnostic. It's a paper-based evaluator. You know, you've got a book that tells you all about you. What you can't hide from is your own actual behavior.
Yeah.
However much you pretend or try to be somebody that you're not, your true self comes to the surface.
Yeah, and that goes back down to imposter syndrome.
It does.
So we're coming to the end of the podcast, and what we've done on all of our podcasts is asked the same five questions. So we'll go through them in no particular order. What did you want to be when you grew up?
Well, in the early days, I wanted to be a chef, I think, but I lived my dream for a good 10, 12 years because I taught windsurfing to level 5.
Really?
And snowboarded and did seasons. So
abroad?
Yeah. Well, around Europe and in the UK. So I kind of lived my ideal dream job. Not that this isn't.
But obviously. Yeah,
that was about some of that.
And what's the worst job you could ever do and why?
Probably the worst job I could ever do is something like a tax inspector, I think. simply because of the thoroughness and attention to detail that's required.
Is that a weakness on your discovery insight?
It is.
You like the bigger things, but don't necessarily like the minute detail.
That's right. You can come to me for inspiration and motivation, but once you want a project plan completed or my admin done, then...
So is your discovery profile very similar to mine?
Our profiles are very similar in the sense of the extroversion. Extrovert thinking is your dominant style. So it's direct, it's forceful, it's straight to the point. Great strategic thinker.
Yep.
Gets the job done. Your secondary preferred style is an extrovert feeling type. So it's engagement, it's visionary, it's getting the people on board, it's collaboration, getting distracted by sparkly things. Whereas my secondary color is the earth green energy.
Right.
So that's more introverted, and it's much more about people and cohesion, and it's about empathy, and it's about collaboration and deeper meaningful conversations, whereas our sunshine layer is a bit more about, gregarious conversations.
Yeah.
So we are quite similar, but you're definitely better at the detail than me.
Oh, really?
Yes.
To be honest, it's not that I don't like detail, it's just it bores me. Which leader do you look up to the most?
It's difficult to pinpoint one particular leader. I think from the words that we shared around great leadership, I think we can take different parts from different people.
Yeah.
Mandela for his complete selflessness in giving himself over. Muhammad Ali for his positivity, his motivation, his drive and being an activist. Einstein, just for bending reality so much and being such an incredible thinker about the world that we live in. And they're certainly the sort of things that I aspire to within my life.
Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn?
You can find us on all at thecolorworks.com, at thecolorworks.
And which one do you prefer?
LinkedIn.
LinkedIn.
Yeah, LinkedIn's our main platform where we pump out the most social content around the behaviours and our informative blogs on current people issues and cultural related matters.
And what was the last book you read?
I struggle to read books through time and actually attention span.
Yeah.
But I chew through a lot of audiobooks.
And what was the last audiobook then? We'll allow this cheating.
This cheating, this skullduggery. Steve Peters' A Chimp Paradox was the last one that I...
That's a very good book.
...got through. Absolutely brilliant book. Absolutely brilliant book. And it really drives home our conscious, less conscious ways of thinking and how destructive our thoughts can be and how we can actually do something about managing them and that we are in control of them.
Yeah.
And we're not out of control of them.
Trying to get that chimp to be quiet.
Put the banana down.
Yes. Thanks, James.
Absolute pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Matt.
Whoa. Don't go anywhere yet. Julio, tell people where they can get more information.
If you like the podcast, go visit saleschange.co.uk.
That's good, but you said .do.
Saleschange.co.uk. Why don't you head... No. It's bad. It's bad. Go to saleschange.co.uk and... saleschange.co.uk and subscribe to our incredible newsletter. Thanks for listening.